If you're one of the millions of Ohio voters who cast a ballot in favor of recreational marijuana sales, we've got news. Ohio state lawmakers have a bill to revise the program, and it could move quickly through the legislature. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we're going to talk about what those changes would look like. We'll also discuss why some Cincinnati public schools students are skipping class because they're afraid, and we'll ask why Cincinnati snowplows seem to skip some streets during the recent winter storm. Joining me now to get us started are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and News Bureau Correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Welcome back, Karen and Sarah.
Hey.
Hey, happy Friday.
Happy Friday to both of you. Sarah, this week, Ohio lawmakers looked to rein in recreational marijuana. There are lots of aspects to this proposal. Tell us how this would change tax collection.
Sure. So one of the biggest changes in this proposal is that it would raise the excise tax on all marijuana product sales from what is currently 10% to 15%. So, you know, you've heard folks who are buying marijuana in Ohio because this program is relatively new. I've definitely heard some complaints from sources about prices. An increase in the excise tax and such a large increase on the excise tax would certainly raise prices as well.
Sure. And those taxes, I understand, would all go to the general fund. Where do tax revenues go under the current law, the law that voters approved in 2023?
Under the current law, there are kind of pools that tax revenue goes to. So one of those pools are going back toward local municipalities who have dispensaries in their communities. There's also a social equity and jobs program to get folks who may be disproportionately at one time impacted by marijuana convictions in the industry and benefiting from the industry. And I should note this bill, as it redirects all tax revenue back to the general revenue fund in the state's discretion, this bill also abolishes that social equity program altogether. So it gets rid of those different buckets and sends everything back toward the general revenue fund. However, I did hear from Senator Steve Huffman, the sponsor of the bill, and he says that is something that could change, that he's leaving it vague for now so there can be broader conversations about what the state and what lawmakers think should be changed about where the tax revenue goes.
Senate President Rob McCauley supports a tax hike, but Democratic Senator Bill DeMora feels these changes fly in the face of voters.
There's an awful lot of societal costs that are going to have to be borne by the legalization of marijuana.
There's no way that I'm going to let all this money go to GRF funds when the voters clearly didn't want that.
Karen, why do supporters of this proposal say it's needed in the first place? Why do they feel like they need to make changes to this law that voters approved in 2023?
Well, first of all, they can, because even though voters approved the law, it is a law. So lawmakers have the ability to make those changes. It's not what happens with a constitutional amendment, but an initiated statute like this one does allow for some changes. And we heard right after this law passed in 2023 that lawmakers really wanted to do some things differently. They didn't like that social equity fund. They were concerned about the concentration in the products. They were concerned about a lot of things. And so I think that the idea that this is going to divert money to help the state and local communities deal with the effects of marijuana is interesting, because I'm not exactly sure what effects he's talking about. There have been reports of officers and troopers waiting outside or near dispensaries when they first opened, but that was a while ago. So I think it's worth a question and a follow-up to find out exactly what the state has seen in terms of effects of the legalization of marijuana.
Sarah, Karen just mentioned the concentration of THC in these products. That's been controversial. How would that change under this proposal?
Yeah, so this proposal sets a max on 35% THC concentration for plant products and then 70% for concentrates and extracts. So if you think of like those vape cartridges, and I think the current max is 90% under issue two. So it does tamp them down. There was that proposal back in 2023 that Karen was kind of mentioning. It's It's not new that lawmakers want to make changes to these relatively young laws around recreational marijuana. And one of the things that they have floated a lot is lowering the concentration. Of course, on the flip side, you hear from marijuana users who say, I'm going to just go to Michigan where I can get products that are more concentrated for cheaper.
And I think it's interesting to note here that that proposal right after the law passed in 2023 didn't move. And I think there might be some concern about how lawmakers would vote. I mean, this is not a partisan issue. I think Republicans have been leading the conversation on this, but there are Republicans who support legalized marijuana. And so I think putting lawmakers on record, especially if they're voting against something that the voters approved, is something that gave some lawmakers a little bit of a pause, at least initially.
I think something that's really quick, Lucy, I'm sorry
sure.
to cut you
oh,
off.
No. Go ahead.
Something that's really important to note about the debate that I've watched and that Karen has watched as the state has, figured out how to put what issue to put in place. Everyone who has come out and testified as a proponent on these marijuana law overhaul bills, they're not necessarily part of the marijuana industry, and they are oftentimes groups that opposed marijuana legalization to begin with.
I know this proposal would also reduce the number of plants residents could grow at home. So that's something that if folks are interested, they should look out for. It sounds like supporters of this bill want to move it quickly in the Senate. Karen, any idea what House leadership thinks of this?
Well, House Speaker Matt Huffman, who was the Senate president up until last year, at the end of the beginning of this year, he was not a supporter of legalized marijuana. And the bill had started in the Senate before. I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought because Matt Huffman has crossed both chambers. So it's hard to keep up sometimes. But yeah, I think with him leading the House, there is more of a chance that it's going to pass than last time around. But again, I think there are some House Republicans who might have some concerns, specifically Jamie Callender, who is a representative from Northeast Ohio and actually cut the ribbon on the opening of one of the dispensaries right after legalization began and sales began. So I think it's got a little bit more work before the House completely signs on to it.
Well, Karen, dozens of other bills have been introduced so far this session, too. Tell us about the Advance Ohio Higher Education Act.
Well, if you're familiar with Senate Bill 83 from last time around, this is a retread of Senate Bill 83 with some important changes. In Senate Bill 83, of course, was the higher education overhaul that conservatives wanted because they said they needed to fight back against what they see as liberal indoctrination going on public university campuses. So this is a bill that would guarantee what they call intellectual diversity. It this time around would ban nearly all diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at public universities, with a few small exceptions. It would also ban faculty strikes. That was something that was in Senate Bill 83, then was dropped to try to get it through the House and get it passed. The sponsor had said if it didn't pass, he was going to bring it back and he was going to restore that ban on faculty strikes, and he has. That's expected to gather a lot of opposition from unions across Ohio. There's some other things in here. It shortens the term of trustees from 9 years to 6 years. It also requires a specific civics course that would focus on American history, key documents, and free market capitalism. And that's just a couple of things that it does. It's a very big bill, and it will probably move fairly quickly because I think a lot of the sponsors feel that it was vetted last time around, so they want to just go ahead and go.
Property tax increases were such a hot topic last year. What kind of legislation has been introduced to address that problem, Karen?
Well, we've got a couple of bills. I think one of the most interesting one is the so-called circuit breaker. This is the one that would cap increases. Like if a homeowner or renter's property taxes exceeded 5% of their income, then it would trigger that. And so that was something that a lot of lawmakers had said that they were in support of, but it didn't get through last time around. That's one of the proposals. There's homestead exemptions. There's other things. But when I talked to Senator Bill Blessing, the Republican from Cincinnati, who's been really big on this issue, he was the chair of a joint committee that looked into property tax laws last session. He says there's two camps here. There's the camp that wants the state to pick up the costs and lower costs for homeowners. But then there's also the camp that wants lower or local communities to pick up those costs. So the question is, if you lower property taxes, somebody has to pay that gap there. And who should be the ones to pay that gap? And that's, I think, going to be the issue for a lot of lawmakers as they go through this process.
There's also legislation related to child care costs and a bill related to school bus safety. Can you tell us quickly about those, Karen?
Well, the school bus safety fund, it's $25 million. It was set up, this would set up that fund. And this comes after a task force last year that Governor Mike DeWine convened that kind of looked into things like seatbelts and other things to try to make school buses safer. And then the child care CRED program, that would set up a system where there would be a cost of child care split evenly among the state, the employer, and the employee. The whole goal is to try to get more affordable childcare. There was this poll out this week that showed that people really struggle to find childcare. And a lot of people, I think it was more than half, said that they have had to change their schedule around because of a lack of affordable childcare. And sometimes they haven't even been able to go to work that they want to.
Sarah, another bill that made headlines this week would abolish the death penalty in Ohio, but it's different from measures like that that have been introduced in the past. Tell us about that.
So obviously lawmakers over the last several legislative cycles have tried and not been able to abolish the death penalty. The new kind of twist on it this time around is that lawmakers who were signing on to this bill, Republicans and a few Democrats as well. And I should say there's a bill in the House and a bill in the Senate. They're identical and they're being introduced very soon. They're still in like the final stages of being worked on. They also include reaffirmations of bans on what they call, quote, end of life funding. So it reaffirms a ban on state money going to abortions, and it reaffirms a ban on state money going toward a physician-assisted suicide. Now, this is something that, again, it reaffirms it. It's not necessarily changing law, sponsors say, because the state already doesn't put money toward abortions, and physician-assisted suicide is criminally punishable in Ohio, so it's not a legal thing. But lawmakers say it's an exercise in compromise, notably Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio. She is sponsoring the bill over in the Senate, and she's a Democrat. She has supported abortion rights movements in the past, but says this is, you know, a compromise between her and a growing contingent of Republicans like Representative Gene Schmidt from the northern Cincinnati suburbs who have come out against the death penalty more recently.
Karen, was that compromise a surprise to you? Are you with us, Karen?
Yeah, I think it is a little bit. It is definitely a new twist on this bill that's been around since 2011. Nikki Antonio first proposed it when she was elected to the House back then. So this is a bill that perennially comes around, or every 2 years, and very rarely moves past one hearing. So this, with some of the people who've signed on and more Republican support, it has a better chance. And of course, in Ohio, we haven't seen an execution since July of 2018. There have been no executions under Governor Mike DeWine. So we're effectively in a moratorium now, but to put it into state law is a different thing.
Supporters of this bill say it's important to combine all these issues in one measure. Here's Republican Representative Adam Matthews.
We cannot and we will not separate these issues because they are united by that single truth, that the state should not put its thumb on the scale by using taxpayer dollars to subsidize death.
Sarah, what have opponents of this bill said about it? You mentioned that there are Republicans and Democrats who have signed on to this proposal. What are opponents saying?
You definitely see an equally bipartisan group of opponents to this bill because, of course, although there is a growing contingent of Republicans, namely Catholic Republicans, who have come out in opposition to the death penalty, there are a number of Republicans, religious lawmakers, who are for the death penalty remaining as an option for whom they call the worst of the worst criminals. So you see Republicans opposing the bill for that reason. But then, of course, there have been abortion advocates who have given the Democrats who signed onto this bill a lot of grief. They said voters in 2023 voted to codify reproductive rights and abortion rights in Ohio's constitution. Why would you go against what the voters want? And even Democrats in the House, the bill in the Senate is bipartisan. There's a Democrat and a Republican on it. Right now, the bill in the House is not bipartisan. It's two Republicans. And House Minority Leader Allison Russo said that her caucus is wary of signing on to anything that cedes ground on abortion rights.
Does this cede ground, though, if it's reaffirming the fact that Ohio doesn't commit public funds to abortion?
Well, that's exactly the argument that Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio is making. She's saying that, you know, this doesn't change the law. Now, I think there are some questions from groups like the ACLU that with the more recent constitutional amendment, could there be some looseness in whether the state could fund abortions? I mean, I've heard that kind of from both sides, but it is how it has been posed thus far is it's just reaffirming what's already in the law.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Great. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too. Up next, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers have made multiple arrests in Chicago, and there are reports of arrests in Northeast Ohio. We'll hear what's happening in Greater Cincinnati. This is Cincinnati Edition. The Trump administration has been making good on its promise to crack down on immigrants in the U.S. without proper documentation. There have been multiple arrests in Chicago and reports of arrests in Northeast Ohio. But what's happening in Greater Cincinnati? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about that are Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. Welcome back, Cameron.
Thank you for having me.
And WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thanks for being here, Zach.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Cameron, we're recording this interview, I want to make clear, on Thursday afternoon. As of now, what do we know about whether there's been increased immigration and customs enforcement activity in the region?
Well, it's been a bit hard to track for sure. We have been looking at watching court documents and court filings. We've been watching the intakes and population at the Boone County Jail, which is one of the closest places in our region that can house house detainees for immigration. And I mean, there's always a baseline of immigration activity that's going on here. And so far, it has not been we have not been able to determine any kind of like increase or decrease. What we do know is that there doesn't seem to be any evidence of large raids or large crackdowns in our area.
Okay. And Cameron, I know the Inquirer interviewed some immigrant support advocates or some immigration support advocates. What are those advocates doing to help immigrants locally?
So we've talked to Nancy Sullivan with Transformations CDC. It's a group, nonprofit based out of kind of the west side of Cincinnati that works with immigrants doing all sorts of different things, not just worrying about immigration issues, but also just helping them settle in, find resources, things like that. And that group, along with a few other groups, are forming quick response teams that are trying to be ready to go out if there are large raids, to assist with people who may be connected with immigrants, undocumented immigrants that might still need help, like their children, things like that, people who wouldn't necessarily be deported but who would rely on an undocumented immigrant as a breadwinner in the home or their parent or something like that. And they're also looking for observers to volunteer to go out and watch when they do learn about actions from the immigration enforcement folks. They want people to be out there kind of observing and taking notes and marking down what they see to make sure things, protocols are followed and things like that.
What are these advocates most worried about?
It's hard to say. I think when I talked to Nancy, I think politically she would fall on the side of being for kind of an advocate for these folks, regardless of their whether they're documented or not. And she's worried that it's going to hurt families, I think, more than anything. And the point that she made was that the immigrants that she knows that are in the country who are undocumented are still trying to learn English. They're trying to get their kids an education, and the vast majority of them, they pay taxes just like everyone else. And one of the things she said to me is there are people who are paying into my Social Security who will never be able to collect.
Zach, I know teachers spoke to the Cincinnati Public Schools Board of Education earlier this week about their concerns. Are they seeing a change in student attendance?
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things that teachers specifically at Aiken High School who showed up to the meeting, they talked about, almost half of their class has, missed missed class since Inauguration Day. And, you know, of course, like we just talked about, there, you know, hasn't been, ICE raids here in Cincinnati or at any Cincinnati public schools that we know of right now on Thursday. But just the stories around the country and the news reports, they said it's really struck fear in a lot of immigrant students at CPS schools. And because of that, they're not showing up.
And so what are they hearing from students? Things like, I really want to be there, but I'm afraid for my that I'll be locked up.
Yeah. They're intimidated. And it's really been keeping them away from the classroom. And they're saying that, these are students who always show up. They show up eager to learn. And, in some cases come from really difficult situations. One teacher from Aiken talked about students from the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Syria and Venezuela and fleeing violence, and how grateful they were to be in Cincinnati and getting a chance to just go to school and learn. These are kids that they said just really enjoyed being there, and now they don't feel like it's a safe place to be anymore.
Zach, what did these teachers want from the board?
They mainly wanted two things, which was a statement of support from the school district. Several large school districts around the country have released certain statements showing their support and informing their schools and educators of what to do if an ICE agent shows up or federal agents show up on campus. So they wanted support, and they also wanted guidance and training for these kinds of situations. Schools have all kinds of emergency training for different things, but really what teachers were looking for was some sort of guidance on this, which they said they hadn't received. I know that CPS did send some guidance out to principals of these schools, but it wasn't widely shared with teachers and staff. It seems to depend on, which school the information was sent to and what those principals chose to do. So some of them have shared some of that information with their teachers, and seems like others haven't. So that's kind of what they're looking for. They're looking for guidance and training because they said, look, these agents could show up anywhere on campus and, they could be trying to talk to somebody who's maybe not working in the central office. It could be, janitorial staff, a teacher aide. It could be a number of different people. Just having the principals know this information, that might not be enough. You really need to have top to bottom. People need to know what their rights are and what procedures they should follow.
Well, I understand Cincinnati Public Schools did eventually issue some kind of statement. What did that say?
Yeah, the day after They teachers demanded a statement. They did release a really brief statement, just saying that they support immigrant and migrant students, and federal agents are not permitted on school grounds without a warrant or a court order. So a very brief statement. Certainly, some people called it generic, and still not really what those teachers were asking for. They're still looking for that guidance. For example, Denver Public Schools, they actually released some guidance publicly, just so all of their employees knew what to do. So they told them to, use the intercom system. Don't let them out of that main office area. Don't let them into the building unless they have a warrant or court order.
By them, meaning ICE agents.
Yeah, ICE agents. And of course, if they're unable to prevent them from going into the building, to contact the school district's general counsel. So something like that is what these teachers were looking for. And right now they're still waiting for it.
Hmm. Cameron, I know you mentioned that you and others at the Inquirer have been trying to track jail dockets and court proceedings and that sort of thing. But what do the numbers show about the number of arrests happening each day during this second Trump administration as compared to what was happening during the Biden administration?
Yeah, so in 2024, under the Biden administration, there were over 100,000 people arrested by ICE. The average came out to about 311 a day. So during this first kind of push since January 23rd, when ICE began posting kind of daily totals on social media, they have been reporting about 710 people a day arrests. So it's only been a few weeks, but just so far between the day that ICE started posting these totals and I believe yesterday, the total was 3,552 arrests across the country. That's not locally, obviously.
Yeah. And Cameron, for people who are in this country without the proper documentation, there is a legal process before they can be deported. What did you all hear from lawyers about that process?
So we talked to a few immigration lawyers, and they said that there is due process that before ICE can remove undocumented immigrants from the country, they need a final order of removal. And that requires a lot of different things to happen before they can just ship people off, according to this lawyer. I think that was something that the legal folks that are involved in these processes, I think, want people to know, is that there's even if you're not a citizen of this country, certain constitutional rights still apply to you. You still have the ability to go through the processes that are set out in the immigration system to fight to stay here or determine whether you're actually here legally or not, that kind of stuff.
Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight and WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion is going to be with us for our next conversation. Thank you so much for being here, Cameron.
Thank you.
We'll be back after a short break to talk about Cincinnati's winter storm response and how Cincinnati Public Schools decides when to close for cold weather. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The weather is ridiculously warm today for January, but many of us are still salty, pardon the pun, about the piles of snow and cold temperatures we endured earlier this month. Joining me to talk about the city's response is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
And WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion is still with us to talk about how Cincinnati Public Schools decides when to cancel classes. Thanks for sticking around, Zach.
Always.
Becca, not long ago, this winter storm walloped Greater Cincinnati. It sounds like lots of Cincinnati residents were disappointed in how the city handled it.
Yeah, definitely. We heard from residents, but also council members were telling the city administration this week that they were just flooded with complaints from residents about unplowed streets or insufficiently plowed streets. Now, we're talking mostly about residential, right? So obviously the main routes were cleared pretty quickly, and those often need to be gone over more than one time by a snowplow or other snow treatment. But looking at some of those especially smaller residential streets, like some of the dead-end streets in the city, you know, hearing reports from residents, including me, that there weren't plow trucks in their neighborhood on those streets for several days after the storm, or some even never.
Yeah, you were working from home a little longer than you expected, if I remember correctly.
I was. And, you know, I managed to get down my little dead-end street in Price Hill, but getting back up was a challenge for several days.
Well, and you mentioned Price Hill. This wasn't just one city neighborhood's residents that were upset, right? I mean, this covered more than one little part of the city.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that just happens to be the neighborhood where I live. But, you know, hearing from Councilmember Anna Albee said she heard from residents just as an example in Mount Washington, Mount Adams, Westwood. You know, it seems like there were kind of pockets all over the city. Again, not really any neighborhood-wide issues, but just residential streets and kind of parts of the city all over.
What's the system that city crews use to figure out if a street's been plowed or if it needs to be plowed or needs some other treatment?
It's a very good question, and we don't have a super clear answer on that. So, you know, what we learned from today was, or this week rather, was we heard from the Department of Public Services director and the superintendent of traffic and roads in that same department, as well as the director of the Office of Performance and Data Analytics. Basically, they presented to council, you know, what the kind of systems are in place, and council kind of picked apart where they felt like there were holes in that system. So what we do know is that when the plow drivers go out and they're assigned a specific route to plow certain streets, that route is all on paper in a physical binder in the plow truck. And so that driver goes out, they kind of go down the list of all of the streets that are intended to be plowed, and they go from there.
That seems like kind of old technology.
Am I 2025?
Okay. Yeah.
I mean,
I like me some paper and a binder, but it seems kind of old.
It's a little bit old school, and you know, it's something where you cannot track where the plow drivers are in real time, you know, which came as a surprise to many of us because the city often touts its plow tracker map, which I'm sure many of us have seen. You know, it's a supposedly interactive real time map where you can see colored lines of where plow drivers have gone. If anybody looked at it this storm like I did, that was a little wonky. You know, there were lines going through city blocks, like where buildings are, so clearly could not have been where a plow truck drove. We kind of learned why this week, and when questioned on that, you know, we learned that that map is the way they described it is it'll ping a plow's location like at the beginning of a street and then again at the end of the street. But the DPS director explained, you know, that doesn't tell us how far down the street the plow went or if they turned off a certain way or if they had their plow down while they were driving. So, you know, the technology that I think a lot of us assumed was being used for these plow tracking systems are actually not being used. And so that's where, you know, things are a lot harder to track than any of us anticipated.
So that website that some of us were looking at that did look a little bit like a toddler got into some crayons and just went crazy on a computer, that is not at all helpful for the employees who are out there, the crews who are out there clearing the roads. It's not like they could look and say, hey, where have my other colleagues been?
The Department of Public Services does not use that map in any way for planning or keeping track of where plows are. It's purely a public information tool. Now, the other way that the city can find out if a street has been plowed is if they get complaints from residents. Now, there are a couple of ways to do that. They encourage folks to use the 311 app, which I did on my street and many of my neighbors did. So that's one way to do it. But we heard from some council members that residents would put in a 311 request and then it would be resolved almost immediately before there was any time for any action to have taken place. Also heard from council members that residents told them
it would say resolved without anything having actually happened on
their
streets.
Like within a few minutes sometimes. You know,
okay.
Obviously
it's
no time
like
for anything to
it's
have
not
happened.
Like their street magically
got
plowed.
But the street
plowed.
Had not been
okay.
plowed.
Okay.
Exactly. You know, and also some residents were kind of calling directly to council members' offices and saying, hey, why isn't my street plowed? And so then council members would put in 311 requests on their behalf or try to contact the Department of Public Services directly. So it seems like there's a lot of pieces here. And none of those systems, if you can call them systems, are talking to each other currently. And that makes for a difficult situation.
Zach, you heard concerns about the winter storm response, too, about the way Cincinnati Public Schools handles snow days and cold days. What concerns did school board members voice about that?
Yeah, well, this was a big topic of discussion earlier this month with the snow and then the very cold days that we had following that. So, you know, with snow days, we all kind of have this idea of what a snow day is and how much snow is too much, and especially the conditions of the road. So when we got hit with that big snowstorm, you know, it made sense that school would be canceled on Monday and Tuesday. So that made sense to a lot of people. But what happened afterwards was during those cold days, they closed because it was cold. But then later in the week, there was another day that was even colder than that, but there was school. And that led to people jumping online, jumping on Facebook and saying, we don't understand what's going on. When is it too cold for school? When is it not? Why isn't this really being explained? So what the school board was asking about was, could the school district create some sort of clearer policy about school days and procedures, snow days? Because right now what Cincinnati Public School has online when it relates to severe weather is they have a statement that says, you know, when they decide to close schools, they talk about analyzing data and consulting various authorities. That's pretty vague and doesn't really mean a whole lot. The superintendent, Shauna Murphy, elaborated on that a little bit, saying, you know, we're talking to principals in buildings and, you know, bus companies and, of course, the road maintenance authorities here in the city, and taking all that information together and considering it and then deciding how to move forward with a snow day. But, of course, that information isn't all posted there online. So it just left a lot of confusion. So really what they were looking for was some sort of update or further elaboration on what a school day means. And part of that was asking about, is there a certain temperature that is too cold for a school day? And right now that doesn't really exist.
Okay, well, and I think the superintendent, if I'm remembering your reporting correctly, also talked about she's even thinking about the hourly employees of the district. Talk about what she said about kind of keeping those considerations and employees in mind and making these decisions.
Yeah, CPS is a huge operation. So they have, you know, salary employees. They also have hourly employees working in these school buildings. Now, when there is a snow day, if an hourly employee misses, you know, a day because of that, you know, it's not great. Of course, nobody wants to lose out on a paycheck. But once that one day becomes 2 days or 3 days or more than that, then it starts becoming a real financial problem for them. So the superintendent said that's also taken to consideration. You know, if we get hit with a lot of snow and we have to cancel school for a few days, that's going to have a real big impact on them. So in certain circumstances, a school district might decide to stay open even if it is really cold or even if there is a lot of snow. Of course, with snow and road conditions, that can greatly affect that. But that's something that they're considering as well.
You've mentioned road conditions. How do the conditions of city streets play into that decision-making process? I mean, did the superintendent kind of draw a line that was probably drawn more clearly than those maps that we just talked about between what the city was doing on clearing roads and the decisions she has to make?
Yeah, it did play a role because it's different depending on where the students are. You know, I'm sure there were some days where for some people getting to school was pretty easy because their road was clear and then the roads around the school were clear. But say if you live on a dead end street that was not plowed, a lot harder to get to school, especially if you're a CPS middle schooler or high schooler and there's no school bus to ride and you have to depend on either, you know, family transportation or the metro bus, public transportation. So that definitely impacts how many kids can get to school. So certainly the situation with the city and the roads, that played an impact on which days they decided to cancel school as well.
Well, and am I right that schools get funded partially based on attendance? So if they have a lot of kids who can't make it, that that's not good for them in terms of learning and funding and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, funding and you know, of course, missing class time. That is a huge thing as well. Now, they do have certain policies that would, you know, allow for some remote learning in certain occasions. They don't always do that. But, you know, losing class time or having to add some days at the end of the year is something that they're also considering and trying to avoid.
Yeah. And all that's tricky for parents who are trying to juggle what will this mean for me and my life.
Yeah. And, parents want a straight answer, but school district can't give it to them.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're talking about dead-end roads, Becca, and that brings us back to you. What's the city doing about this problem with these systems, if you can call them systems, and how they don't connect or do connect? Is this a priority for City Council and for the administration?
Certainly a priority for City Council. You know, they had some strong words for administrative officials this week based on their disappointment in this, what they called a system breakdown. We did hear briefly from City Manager Cheryl Long. She said there's a comprehensive review going on about winter operations. She says that review actually started before this winter storm in early January and says, unfortunately, it just wasn't completed in time for any solutions to be implemented before that storm hit. But she says that does include looking at technology solutions. It seems like there are some maybe roadblocks to implementing technology like other cities might have. And so that's all these different solutions that they're going to be considering. And then hopefully we'll hear back on that report in the next couple of months, you know, and hopefully we also don't get another huge winter storm this season.
Yeah. We got an email from Debbie, who lives in Coleraine Township. So this is not the city of Cincinnati, but Coleraine Township. Debbie writes, during that blizzard, the plow came into our cul-de-sac, but only cleared half of it. He literally plowed the near half and left the rest of us blocked in by 15 to 20 feet of snow that was 12 to 15 inches deep. Some kind of neighbor came around in a little green and yellow John Deere riding snowblower and finished clearing the cul-de-sac and even plowed several of our driveways, very upset with the township snowplow. So it sounds like these concerns go beyond the city of Cincinnati, if that gives anyone in the city some comfort. I should say cold comfort. Is that? I'm getting a little too pun
crazy. You're on fire today, Lucy.
On fuego, yes. So what solutions is the city considering, Becca? And are these new ideas? I mean, this is, it's not the first time it's snowed and people have been upset with the city's response.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that council members really hounded on as well, is, you know, this isn't the first time that there have been complaints and issues with city winter response. And yeah, these ideas that are being tossed around, not necessarily new. Obviously, the technology we've really already talked about. Other ideas, you know, if you think about it, you can't really, you know, you don't want to hire 100 people just as snowplow drivers and they're only going to work 2 or 3 days a year. You know, that doesn't make any sense. So, you know, the plow drivers that the city works with are also the folks who fill potholes and mow grass on public property and pick up litter and things like that. So those folks are moved over during times of winter storms. And then the other idea is to supplement that with other qualified folks who work in other departments, like, say, Parks and Recreation, or, you know, other departments of the city that may be able to drive these plow trucks. That's something the city does do. But one idea was to bring them in earlier in the storm. You know, that's something that they seem to have done a day or two later, but instead bringing them in earlier so they can start clearing those residential streets, you know, right away, you know, as opposed to waiting. Again, not necessarily a new idea. Also, you know, working with vehicles, kind of retrofitting vehicles from other departments with plow or ice treatment equipment that can be used. You know, again, you don't want to buy 50 new plow trucks that are going to sit in a garage most of the time. But if there's a way to use existing city resources to kind of supplement during times of, you know, extreme winter weather, again, not a new idea. And that's something that Councilmember Jeff Kramerding pointed out. He said, you know, he worked as an aide in council 20 years ago and says, you know, we talked about all this then. You know, where do all these ideas go? We seem to forget the lessons we've learned in between these big winter storms. But we'll see if that happens this time.
Yeah, it gets warmer. Some people are not as mad anymore, but I imagine some people stay mad until the next snowstorm. Is this something that could come up in the city's budgeting process? I mean, it sounds like some of this might require some funding, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, council has already kind of started talking about, does there need to be a new investment in newer vehicles? Because a lot of the winter weather vehicles are very old and break down maybe more easily. Also looking at staffing, you know, is there a way to supplement staffing with, you know, bonuses, things like that to kind of help with that? Absolutely will be part of the city budget discussion, but it'll be one part of many, many, you know, tough budget conversations council's going to have this year. With ARPA federal stimulus money, you know, run out, this is a top priority now because it's top of mind. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, how many other priorities are going to be top of mind by the time we get to May and June when they really have these conversations.
You have mentioned that federal money, those ARPA dollars are gone. So it's not going to be a happy budget year probably, huh?
It'll be tough, especially after a couple of years of really kind of budget, you know, floating on cloud nine budget years. That's so much money from the federal government to fill those deficits and work on kind of these projects that otherwise would not be possible. And those years have ended, my friend.
Yes. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thank you both so much for your time today. I hope you both have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
Thanks,
too.
Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.